Welcome to ESAB's Global Economy Podcast. My name is Fredrik Eriksson, and in today's episode, I am talking to Changgong Ri, the Director of the Asia and Pacific Department at the International Monetary Fund. The global economy, says the IMF in a recent forecast, is projected to shrink by 4.9% in 2020. The COVID-19 pandemic has had a more negative impact on economic activity in the first half of 2020 than anticipated, and the recovery is projected to be more gradual than previously forecasted. I spoke to Changgong Ri in an event that we at ESAB hosted a few weeks ago, and we covered lots of different issues, including the economic effects of the COVID-19 crisis in Asian economies, main risks for the economic recovery, and what advice that the IMF has given to various governments in the Asia and Pacific region to speed up the recovery and return those economies to economic growth. All right, everybody, it's time for us to start. So welcome to this webinar. We're very pleased to have you join us today, Dr. Ri.
Good evening. Thank you for this opportunity.
Indeed, thank you very much. And good morning to you, I should say, because you're joining us from Washington, D.C., where it's shortly after 9 o'clock in the morning now. So I want to get right into our discussion about the theme, and you're going to start off with a couple of introductory remarks. I don't think the topic itself requires a long introduction because the entire world suffers from the economic fallout of the pandemic. Asia and the Pacific region have been strong engines of growth in their own region and the world for some time now, and their pace of recovery will have an impact not just on their region, but also on the global economic recovery. So, Dr. Ri, what are the expectations for economic recovery in Asia and the Pacific region?
Thank you. You know that we revised down our global forecast from minus 3% to around minus 4.9, close to minus 5% in global economy. Asia was not an exception. We revised down our growth forecast from 0% to minus 1.6%. We revised down almost all Asian countries, with a few exceptions, including Australia. But I think I want to emphasize that probably people didn't notice very well, but I think the more important fact is that we revised down our forecast for 2021 also. For example, in Asia, in April, we expect Asia's growth will rebound to 7.6%, but now we revised down this 2021 growth rate is to 6.6%. But behind this 6.6% growth recovery, fund assume that there won't be a big second wave in the global economy. At the same time, even if there is a second wave, the reaction of the government will not be as strict as we see in the first phase. And so that this recovery will be led by the private sector, consumption and investment. If you look at the source of growth in 2020, almost all sources of the growth, positive sources from the government stimulus, and all private demand, consumption, investment, all decline. One unique feature of this coronavirus is that consumption drops, much more severely than investment as obvious reasons. So if our assumption that the private sector activity will resume from the second half of this year, and especially 2021, if this is not realized, I think then there is a downside risk. And on top of it, there are many reasons, Asia-specific reasons, why even though 2020, Asia is doing better than others because, China, Korea, they have early break of the virus and they relatively successfully contain the, the spread of the virus. So they could start the reopening earlier. And many other Asian economies introduced more preemptive measures, which is relatively, compared with other regions, was successful. So 2020, Asia is doing better, even though the shock itself is quite big. On the other hand, if you look at the what recovery phase from 2021, I have many reasons why Asians should not be complacent and they cannot decouple from the global economy. First of all, many Asian economies heavily depends on trade. And as you know, that we revised down Europe's growth rate quite significantly to minus 10%. U.S. growth rate is now forecast to minus 8%. So trade will be a very difficult factor for Asia to cope with. And then also the longer than expected lockdown in some cases in Asia. For example, there are several countries which hasn't been successful yet in containing the measures. And then also in general, there is asymmetry between the containment policy versus exit policy. One of our interesting study shows that exit policy, it was introduced, it has a negative impact of -12% of growth in a month. On the other hand, if you fully reopen those measures, still the positive impact will be only +7%. So there is a gap between exit and re-entry. And then it's very easy to understand, because if you have this coronavirus, will have a definitely significant impact on people's behavior, especially and consumption. And then also, if you think about heavy reliance on the informal sector in Asia, and those sectors, tourism, remittance, all the sectors will have a heavy toll in many Asian countries. So overall, I think what I'm worried more about is not, relatively speaking, we are better in 2020, but I'm a little bit concerned in 2021. And few other points is that, yes, Asia has heavily relied on the monetary and fiscal policy, as in other advanced economies, in coping with this first wave of coronavirus. As compared with the advanced economies like Europe and US, which can rely on the internationalized currency, so they can actually become more aggressive in monetary policy and fiscal policy. Many Asia EMs have a relatively little fiscal and monetary spaces, because when they use the stimulus policies, they have to consider the negative spillover to their exchange rate and also credit rating, all these things. So far they use a quite significant amount of these measures in their own standard. But if the second wave happens, or the growth rate is not recover very fast in the 2021, we are worrying about what kind of space they have. So in policy-wise, I think Asia is in the second stage of exit. So in some sense, start to reopen the economy gradually. So this is time they have to think about how to continue their stimulus to protect the nascent recovery, but at the same time, think about how to use their limited policy space more wisely. For example, in the first phase, the focus was preventing the bankruptcy of the incumbent companies, because we don't know whether which company is insolvent, which company is liquidity risk. But from now on, probably considering the limited policy spaces, their focus has to be on the general stimulus, not targeted, but generally for the general economy recovery. At the same time, they have to think about how to ensure right allocation of resources, not just helping the bankruptcies of the incumbent company, but move the resource to a more sectors which can survive after the coronavirus. At the same time, there are so many informal sector workers was outside of the social safety net. For example, unemployment insurance in many Asian countries in general is very weak, do not cover very poor and migrant workers. How to protect the livelihood of these people who's heavily hit will be another big factor. If I just add one more, is that because of the invention of the vaccine or the new treatment measures, definitely there is a upside risk. And if the upside, as of now in our forecast, China's growth rate from 6.0% in 2019 to now we are forecasting 2020 growth rate in China be 1%. So 6 to 1% is a big drop. On the other hand, if you look at their trade performance in the first half of this year, and then given that they have a large fiscal room to react, and then if the this new vaccine or medication is developed, uncertainty is reduced. I think if there is any country who can rely on domestic demand and to have a recovery sooner, it will be on China. But on the other hand, we are not expecting that China will bail Asia out this time, unlike global financial crisis period. During the global financial crisis, you remember that China's growth rate was maintained close to 10%, because they heavily rely on the fiscal expenditures, which is basically well above 8% of GDP in 2009 alone. But they learned a lesson that excessive stimulus packages can have a large negative impact down the road. And also this time, unlike global financial crisis, they are also affected domestically. So this time, I think China's growth rate will, even if there is upside potential, will be slightly above 1% than we expected, close to 2%. That means that China will not bail out the difficulties that Asians have, unlike 2009.
Thank you very much, Dr. Ri. Can you give us some more flavor about differences and similarities in the region when it comes to economic performance? Are we talking about sort of a drop now and a slower recovery than expected, which applies to the entire region? Or do you see significant differences between countries in the region?
Actually, there is a, definitely Asia is a very heterogeneous group. So the, how much they are affected and how fast their recovery will be depends on many factors. First, as you mentioned, where they are currently at the epidemic curve and whether you have controlled the epidemics relatively well or not. And also depends on policy spaces and whether they have enough room to react. And third is economic structure. For example, whether you are heavily depends on tourism, remittance, or whether you have some kind of industry which can actually benefit from this working from home. So whether how much your economy diversified, those factors will definitely affect. More concretely, I think then we revise down most of the growth in Asian countries because of external factors, as you mentioned. If the global economy slow down, depending on the heavy international trade and tourism dependency, I don't think Asia can grow completely decoupled from the rest of the world. So in general, I would rather say Asia is going down and then recovery will be protected. We are assuming that even with a 6.6% growth rate in 2021, the Asia's income level in 2020, per capita income in 2022, will be 5% lower than the past that we imagined, we forecasted before the COVID. But there is some exception, Australia, because they did a lot, preemptive, containment measure, even though recently there is some new outbreak in Melbourne. So we revised down growth rate in quite significantly, well below 7% in previous, now slightly revised over their growth forecast. China, and then also the largest, on the other hand, largest revision down is happened to India because, despite their strong, they introduced preemptively the containment measure, which was a right choice. But unfortunately, India is now not controlling the, epidemics completely. So now they become number three in the world. I heard in recent news in terms of the number of people affected. So we had to revise down their growth rate to minus 4.5% in fiscal year 2020. In the beginning, it was in April, we are focusing about 1.9, positive 1.9%. So it's quite significant revision, negative revision, because of the, they are not controlling the epidemics yet. And then, Japan, the mixed feeling, mixed statistics, the global trade, all this has negative impact. On the other hand, they announced quite significant fiscal packages. If you include their equity, loan, guarantee, everything, their stimulus package is around 35% of GDP, which is quite significant. Yes, so we have a concern on the long-term debt, but their stimulus is quite significant. Because of that, we basically maintain the almost very close Japan's growth forecast to at minus 5.8% in 2020. China, yes, China's growth rate dropped, as I mentioned, 6% to 1%. In last year, 6% is 1%. In April, we forecast China's growth rate around 1.2%, but we revised down to 1% very slightly, mostly because of external factors. But if you look at their statistics between January and March, March was kind of bottom because of the containment measure. But late March and April, we see many signs of the recovery. So they are on the path to recovery. And then Korea followed a very similar pattern, and they are very heavily dependent on export. But general exports going down, but they actually, like China, they export in medical products, and then also their export on semiconductor products, which is now increasing quite rapidly because of demand from the working from home. So some of them is offsetting their slowdown. And in many ASEAN economies, I would rather say, previously I can usually talk about ASEAN as a homogeneous group, but this time it's quite different, First of all, many countries are in different stage of the pandemic, and Indonesia still trying to control it. Thailand and a few other ASEAN economies already have a very low rate of infection. And then economic structure is quite different. For example, Thailand, we are worrying about Japan syndrome. Now, if there is any shock in the financial market, Thai baht becomes a safe haven among ASEAN economies. So and the interest rate is very low. Inflation is almost negative. So they have to think about whether they have to use unconventional policy, how to do the policy like advanced economies. On the other hand, other ASEAN economies, as I mentioned, has to worry about capital outflow still. And then also they have a relatively less fiscal space than Thailand. So when they do the stimulus, they have to think about credit rating impact and others. So ASEAN economies at this moment doing a relatively better than other regions in containing the measures. But on the other hand, they have a quite heterogeneous policy challenges at this moment.
Okay, thank you. Let me actually continue on the same note about similarities and differences between countries in the region. So you've already mentioned that there has been measures taken in order to reduce the impact of the economic slowdown. So we've had support measures going to households, to firms to avoid bankruptcies. And the pattern here is basically that countries with more fiscal space, I suppose, have taken more actions than countries with less fiscal space. So if we sort of begin to untangle that a little bit more, if we start on the fiscal side, are we seeing now any other type of measures coming, which is not really intended in order to soften the blow of the economic contraction coming from the pandemic, but more looking towards trying to give stimulus to an economic recovery? Are various governments now beginning to think about sort of the second step or the third step in terms of generating a faster recovery? Or are they still sort of in that phase when they're trying to avoid the decline to become larger than it needs to be?
That depends on where they are at the pandemic. For example, like whether they are moving the first phase of the stimulus, which basically preventing the slowdown, versus now whether they are moving to the more, policy toward a more greener, fairer, and smarter recovery in phase two. I think at this moment, China, Korea, who actually did the early exit and then reopening, that they are thinking about phase two more than other countries. But for other Asian countries, I'd rather say they are still at the first stage of the stimulus at this moment, because they've contained the spread of the negative impact. But I think when I ask you whether they have the real one factor that you mentioned is fiscal space, but there is the other factor, which is whether the country has an international currency or not, is another important factor in Asia. If you look at in Asia, advanced Asia, such as Japan, who has international currency, Australia, who has international currency, and then Singapore, who can access the U.S. Fed swap lines and then in well-developed financial market, they did a very aggressive stimulus packages, as in other advanced economies in Germany, U.S., and others, because they can afford to. On the other hand, many Asian countries, even Korea, who has a large fiscal space in our view, are very concerned about the impact on exchange rate if they do the very big stimulus packages. And then, like ASEAN countries also do, impact on the exchange rate, because they have a balance sheet issue. If the currency depreciate, their burden can actually increase in the dollar denominated debt. So depending on that, the policy mix is very, changes. One interesting issue at this moment is that what happens if there's a second wave happens? Because many Asian economies rely on this large, relatively large investment stimulus as in the first stages, whether they can afford to, and what will be the impact on exchange and others. So among the Asian policymakers now, what we are discussing is that whether, if that things happens, what kind of policy mix is necessary? So it's not just the fiscal stimulus. Can they use the monetary space too? For example, if you just print out the money, then there's inflation, pressure can happen, and they may lose the reputation they have been building long time for their central bank independency. But in that case, can they rely on some idea that the US has used and UK has used, something like there is any backstop from the fiscal agency, some kind of credit guarantees for the central bank, then where the central bank can actually do more liquidity service in that way? Is it better in terms of impact on credit rating and in these things compared with just increasing the budget deficit or just increasing the money supply? So there is a kind of many discussion how they can use and have a right policy mix. That includes also the use of the capital flow measures, sometimes called capital control. In March, when there is a large capital outflow from the region, there is a concern whether they have to use capital flow measures on orthodoxically. But now after March, the actually current situation in financial market is much subdued and much stabilized. So there's no discussion at this moment. But if there is a second wave, if there is another round of the capital outflows, I think what is the right combination of policy mix, fiscal, monetary, and the regulation at the same time, capital flow measure. These are the kind of topics they are heavily discussing at this moment.
Okay, thank you. I have actually two follow-up questions from attendees related to this. A first question starts by commending the IMF for taking good actions in order to help countries with the provision of dollar-based liquidity during the crisis, and is now asking the questions whether there is an opportunity for the IMF to engage in bilateral swap lines, which potentially can have the effect of helping some of these countries in the region to, in the first place, of course, access international capital, but in the second place, then use monetary policy as a way to stimulate the economy as well.
Actually, you know, I should have mentioned in early that this time IMF, I'm working on, so maybe self-praising, but we actually react very quickly under our new leadership. Our new MD, Kristalina, actually really pushed us to provide a lot of emergency lending, you know, it's unprecedented way. So we are currently providing our emergency lending program more than 72 countries as of now. We are working on it. And that is not only the liquidity support, but also the helping the, some of the small island countries which are actually losing their growth model. For example, you know, if I look at the Pacific Island countries, there is no outbreak of the coronavirus except a few countries. But they are heavily hit because tourism basically vanishes. So the growth model vanishes. So we cannot call this a liquidity problem. It's something like a real solvency problem for the time being. And they could not have any other resources if this continues. So for those countries, I think international support and also international financial institution support is essential. So that's what we are actually doing. And at the same time, in terms of dollar liquidity, yes, actually, we are not directly supporting swap lines to the central bank, but we have very similar facilities introduced in this April, which is called short-term liquidity line. So that line is that we provide a checking account to the countries which need some short-term liquidity in this kind of period. So they can actually then withdraw before the crisis and then, you know, pay back and then withdraw again if necessary. So they can be recurrently do this kind of, you know, operations. And then also, unlike the other program, which the country has to request the program to the IMF, which has a lot of stigma effect in the Asia countries, this new facility SLL called informally ask whether they are qualified, we can tell them that whether you're qualified or not. Then actually, fund can offer if the authorities are interested. We can offer whether you want to have this facility or not. So we are trying to mimic the Fed. Swap line as much as possible to reduce the stigma impact on the other Asia IMF program. So I can say that we have a new facility which mimics the swap lines from the Fed.
All right, thank you. And here's another question which related to the discussion we had. And this question starts by observing that the OECD has issued an analysis or a comment which suggests that OECD member countries should look for opportunities to scale back emergency measures that have been taken, especially furlough schemes that support labor directly, and find other means of supporting firms and labor, because as they are arguing, there will be structural changes in the economy, and many of the companies that are now receiving support, they will not survive in the future, and it's much better to help to facilitate labor mobility between surviving firms and non-surviving firms. So the question is this something you have observed at the IMF as well, that countries in the Asia-Pacific region, the extent to which they have relied on furlough similar type of schemes and now need to begin to think about other ways of getting labor into growing sectors rather than staying in firms that may not survive?
Yes, I think this is a definitive direction that we have to go. The question is that it's much easier to say than done, and for various reasons. But I think it's inevitable because, government can continue to provide liquidity and, the money to the incumbent companies and expecting that they will recover, because there will be definitely big structural changes. So tourism, for example, I don't think that, old way of doing the tourism businesses will survive after the coronavirus. And there will be many winners and many, losers too. So I think in general, the principle that we have to protect people, not jobs, is very important. And especially in Asia, as I mentioned in the introduction, there are so large informal sectors, which is outside of the social safety net. So in Asia, I think this time, if I add more, then moving the resources to more efficient sector means there is a losers too, right? I think at this moment, it's a very important time for us to strengthen social safety net, especially it's now we realize that Asia really need to enhance the automatic stabilizer by introducing social safety net, because in Germany, many other European countries, the response was more immediate because they have a stronger automatic stabilizer. But Asia, because we do not have automatic stabilizer, we have to come up with more discretionary measure. And once you discretionary measures introduced, politically it's very hard to rewind, right? So I think there are many more medium-term homework, you know, from this coronavirus, how we can change our Asia's structures. But definitely, I think that from liquidity, targeted support to a more companies and protecting people rather than job, more structural, efficient way of providing general stimulus is called for at this moment in Asia.
All right, thank you very much. We're soon going to talk a little bit more about the drivers of economic recovery, but I want us to stick for a little bit longer sort of on the analysis that you and your colleagues have provided about the situation right now. You are mentioning that there are a couple of downside risks. You said in your introductory remarks that it may be the case that we're going to have muted global trade growth, or that global demand will be reduced for a longer period of time than you initially thought. And that's going to have, of course, a consequence on the trade side for Asian countries. You also mentioned that there are maybe other risks, like, for instance, corporate balance sheets may be a bit unbalanced, or that they are sort of now sort of facing a situation where corporates are heavily indebted, and that may present a risk in itself. I'm curious about that. Why do you think that there is risk sort of a corporate balance sheet type of problem? What's behind that particular analysis?
If I generalize, I do not mean that Asia's corporate sector is really heavily indebted and sooner or later they will have a serious problem. I do not mean that. I do not mean this kind of crisis. But my view is because we are worried because of protracted recovery. As I told you, that unless there is a vaccine or the treatment is developed very soon, there will be a behavioral change. So, and then also trade slowdown. And that means that behavioral change means the domestic demand won't increase very rapidly, consumption in particular. And now trade is going down. External sector will be also, won't be helped Asian countries very well. That means that if Asia's growth rate slow down, and then, and then at the same time, I'm just thinking about the really bad scenario. Now, because the advanced economies start to recover, they have to unwind their financial policies, which means the interest rate go up, and all this negative shock happen all together. Then the profitability of the many companies will go down, especially because of structural reason. Some company which depends on the old model of businesses will have a more problem because of structure change. Then these corporations will have difficulties. If they fail, that will have a balance sheet impact on the bank. These are the kind of slowly moving, scenario that we are worrying about in Asia. So if you look at the 2009 exchange rate fluctuation, all things suddenly, impact the, certain section of the financial sector. But this time the shock is coming from the real sector. So if the real sector grows slow down, that may have an impact on the financial sector. That is a kind of scenario that I worry about.
Then let us talk a little bit about the drivers of economic recovery that I mentioned before. So you're pointing to private consumption as one of the potential drivers here, since external demand is a bit muted. So what is the space for private demand to help economies to recover? Are households sort of in a good financial position, meaning that they can change their savings consumptions balance a bit and start to spend more? Do governments preparing to do different types of reforms that can help to spur private consumption more?
Driver can mean different things, but I think because consumption was really dropped significantly because containment measures, once you reopen, naturally it will rebound, right? So it's a technical rebound because it drops quite significantly. In that sense, we are assuming that this technical rebound will happen. Is it going to be really happen strongly so that to compensate some of the bygone consumption too? So that's a question. In April, we are showing relatively higher rebound. But now we find that that assumption may be too optimistic, because now we are seeing many evidence that people's behavior changes. Unless there is a new scientific way of assuring that this won't be a problem, people will be more cautious. So rebound may happen, may not as strong as before we imagined. Second, I think the all government measures, government support, during this first phase of the pandemic, provide some of the income support, but it's a temporary, right? So unless it's a permanent income increase, the consumption may not increase, as before. So altogether, I say that the consumption can be a driving force in the sense there's technical rebound from the sharp slowdown once the economy reopens, as long as we assume there's no second wave. But it won't be enough to move the economy back to before the coronavirus growth path. There must be something else. And that something else, I think, should be some more investment or some resource allocation of better sector. So how you can change the structurally to the new economy, that's very key. To me, I see some sign of the hope and some sign of the the pessimism. For example, a country who depends heavily on international tourism, and the country who heavily depends on remittance flows in Asia, and countries who heavily depends on labor supply from the migrant workers. I believe that will take a time more than a year, right? As you can see, are you going to travel immediately to the mini vacation? So probably an abroad, probably not, even though there's a vaccine available. So I think those countries probably will have a hard time to having a new drivers very soon. That's a worry about many Asian countries. I'm not supposed to mention names, but many countries I'm worrying about in that category. On the other hand, countries who can benefit from the structural changes, as I mentioned in the introduction, if you look at the China's export from January to May, it surprised us that the drop in China's trade was not as significant as before. For example, we are focusing the global trade will shrink -12% in 2020. If you look at the January to May, China's trade slowed down only -5%, even though China's heavy volume of the global trade, which is much milder than, it drops, but much milder than we expected. Why? We find that their medical supply to the world is high, and also their export in semiconductors, which the demand has increased because working from home, same phenomenon in Korea. So those countries which has some product they can sell under the new environment, they are actually, they can do better. So new driver depends many, many factors, in my opinion.
It's a follow-up question here. Draws on experiences in Europe, looking at private consumption during March, April, and May, and which is saying that there is a sharp difference between countries in how much private consumption declined, and a large portion of that variation can be explained by the degree to which the countries had modernized retail sectors, basically through e-commerce and basically offering opportunities for people to have food and other retail goods shipped to the homes directly. What are the patterns we're seeing in Asia here? Supposedly, many of the East Asian countries are more advanced than other countries in the world when it comes to e-commerce. Has e-commerce and digitalization softened the blow to private consumption? That was the question.
Agree. Actually, if you look at the China, Indonesia, many ASEAN economies, including Korea, online sales, online businesses actually, is a lifeline at this moment. Actually, it really cushioned the negative shock of the economy. And so that's, I think, a country which has a better digital infrastructure, high-speed internet, and the country which has more online businesses, are doing relatively much better than the others. So same phenomena. So, but that at the same time, that really, differentiate who losers versus winner, maintain. Who can actually work at home? Who can access the internet? Working at home is one of the feasibility. Those people are less suffered. But on the other hand, person who has to meet people to the businesses, person who cannot do the access to the internet, those sectors are really devastated. So I think it's a global phenomenon.
Another question also related to this, but this is more about structural changes in Asia's export profile. And the question is like this. So we saw during the global financial crisis or the financial crisis in 2008-2009, Asia's export profile slightly changed as a consequence of the slowdown in America and Europe. The growth of global trade in the first place became slower than it had been before the crisis, but also that there were a couple of structural changes leading Asian economies to change into more highly value-added types of export. What are your expectations for changes to the structure of Asia's export as a consequence of this crisis? Will we see less export of the type of industrial goods, perhaps, that we have seen dominating Asian exports in the past? And as a consequence, will they climb into higher value-added exports, for instance, in services?
to me, this is a really important question, but I have to admit that we do not have a good data to analyze these things. We talk a lot of possibility, but so far I have to say that we see some anecdotes, some changes, but we do not have a very consistent data set to show the trend. So but I can mention a few things. Definitely, I think this change of global value chain started even before the coronavirus, simply because of more anti-globalization sentiment, which will be strengthened after the coronavirus, but that started earlier. And then also because of the labor, wage level in Asia is naturally increasing fast, especially in China. So they forced to move the Asians to move over to the global value chain. Whether these changes will intensify the more global value chain within ASEAN countries, for example, some of labor intensive product will move from China to Vietnam and other low-income countries in Asia, or whether you're going to go to the other regions such as Africa. We see both trends, but it's kind of, the movement is already happened. China is moving from the factory of the world to the consumer of the world. The middle income class is rising too. So that trend was there. But whether it's going to be successful and how fast it's going to be, there are, I hope this is inevitable. Asia need to reduce first the export dependence, because whole world changes and that they cannot just rely on the export. Country like China, big country, has to rely on the domestic demand. India definitely will do. So I think there will be a change, but how fast and how successful? I have a few questions. One is that if you still look at the trade pattern, even though intra-regional trade is increasing, still the final product tend to go to Europeans and America. So unless the destination of final product has changed, the dependence on the other region still remains. But if you look at the intra-regional trade, I'd rather say that the same problem exists even within the intra-regional trade. The low-hanging fruits is already taken, basic product, all these things. Whether they can open the service sector, whether they can open more higher value item, politically sensitive item each other, I don't see that trend happening. Actually, if you look at the trade openness of the Asian economies, you can see that it plateaued in the middle of 2000. After that, it's kind of remained same level because, labor mobility and, intellectual product property right, and then also, service sector mobility is as limited as in their relation with other countries or advanced countries. To our disappointment, the tariff rate among the, Asian region in general is not lower than this tariff rate against the advanced economies. So I would rather say that if Asia want to increase intra-regional trade and moving up the value chain, this has to be fixed. Low-hanging fruit is already taken. Second, factor is a technology. Now we are talking about low-end product, but Asia has to move up the value chain. So far, that's one of the why I worry about U.S.-China tension. It's not just a trade, actually technology. Without having access to the advanced economic technology, can Asia continue to move up the ladder at this moment? Ideally, I think Asia has to have their own good education system, has to be able to develop their own technology. But are we at that stage at this moment? So if the each country close down each other, actually, I think it's a bad thing, including technology. Whether this is going to expedite the change of global value chain, I think we have to look at it. So definitely trend is there, it's changing slowly, even before the global financial crisis. But this trade tension, technology tension, and the political economy among Asian economies, that will all impact how soon this is going to happen.
Do you see developments now which are leading to more trade restrictions in the region, in trade between countries in the region? I mean, we're seeing that, for instance, in Europe, where we've had export curbs introduced during the pandemic. I mean, these curbs have mostly been in medical products that were in short supply, but there have been a few other examples as well where when new restrictions have come, which have affected regional trade quite substantially. So what's the situation been in Asia?
So far, when I talk with the policymakers and the government officers, it's kind of assuring that they all emphasize the benefit of the globalization, even though that the globalization has many problems. Actually, we have to have a new globalization, open our economy by addressing some of the weakness of the previous globalization trend. So it's promising that the policymakers are still saying that. But on the other hand, I cannot exclude the possibility that the political pressure for closing and protecting domestic industry won't rise as fast. Because you know, income inequalities will rise. And this informal sector workers who was heavily hit will have faced more difficulties. Given a relative lack of social safety net, they will resist the transformation of economy structural wise. So I think the populist demand to protect the people who are suffering now will rise. I really hope it won't happen, but I have to say that I cannot exclude the possibility that the rising populism is also will happen in Asia. I think that possibility is real.
All right. I have a question here, which is also related to what we just talked about and what you said previously about your fear that trade tensions between United States and China may lead to lower access to key technologies, at least in the short to medium term future for some Asian economies. So the question is basically about a structural change in globalization, which has made the Asian region as well as the rest of the world more dependent on technology, sharing of ideas, innovations across borders, knowledge, education, that even if we may have new restrictions coming on certain goods, the fact that we'll have a lot more people collaborating across borders but at university levels or corporate R&D, that this is such a powerful driver that it's going to be almost impossible to resist sort of the potential gains you will get from integrating a lot more through technology, ideas, knowledge. What are you seeing as the prospect for Asian economies here in terms of intra-regional economic integration? Is there strong patterns of ideas exchange with university collaborations, with students sort of moving across borders in order to attain a degree? What about collaborations between corporate R&D sectors and universities in different countries? Is this something that has also grown strongly in Asia?
Yes, actually, if you look at the last 20 years, the mobility and the inter-regional cooperation among the universities and in academic society and the company level is visibly high. For example, Australia is one of the magnet of the many foreign students in the region. Singapore have many international schools. And even my home country, compared with 20 or 30 years ago, I see this time many international students from Asia, but all over the world, in Korea too. But I want to emphasize that this inter-regional trade and the technology cooperation integration cannot be happen just isolated, just inter-regional. This has been together with the globalization. So it's a part of the globalization. I think Asia alone can be just do it ourselves. So as an economist, you will agree that the benefit of having all this open economy for global is the best. Right? In doing so, international trade and the international cooperation also increase. So in principle, we believe that this is the way to go, even though, and then at the same time, we have to address the issue of that there is a winners and losers, all these things. But so that is why we are very one concern on current political situation where each country can be more inward looking as in the before the World War II. So I think, you know, as an international organization, as proper people who are persons working in the international organization and also economists, we really believe that the solution has to be found in a multilateral way very soon. Not to cause a permanent damage in the global economy.
Indeed. We are getting close to the end now, and I have there are a few more questions that people have asked. I'm going to end with one of them, which is returning us to the potential for underlying financial sector risks in the region. And we covered that a little bit in the past when you were saying sort of that in this crisis, it's more of a sort of a business fundamental crisis. It's not emerging from the financial sector. It's emerging from the real economy. It may migrate into the balance sheets of banks and others. But what are your sort of general perceptions here about the underlying strength of the financial sector in the Asian region? To what extent do you at the IMF believe that there are certain type of risks and worries here? And related to that, there is also specific questions about the shadowing banking sector and whether that is presenting a systemic risks, given that we have sort of relatively high levels of corporate debt, as we talked about.
Let me go back to the your last part, the shadow banking and the fundamental structural weakness of the banking sector in Asia and the capital market too. That was a structural problem even before the COVID-19. I can mention several, you know, there are several Asian countries who has been ramping up their structural reform in financial sector because their leverage also increased rapidly even before the COVID. And in, but those countries under the COVID had to stop their effort because natural reason, because they have to provide more liquidity in the first phase of the crisis. So definitely, I think COVID-19 has a negative impact on the effort for the structural reform in this bank sector weakness, which pre-existed before the coronavirus cases. So that is a kind of structural thing that country has to revisit and then has to revamp the effort. So I won't deny that the many Asian countries really clean banking sector and capital market. There is a fundamental problem. We all know it. And now it's temporary halt because of COVID. That will make the medium-term risk much higher. So they have to go back to this risk. And as for the discrepancy between the financial sector and the real economy, as manifested, we are talking all over the world. Asia is not an exception. Asia's stock market and you know, bond prices all probably recovered almost close to the pre-COVID you know, level, even though economy is slowing down quite significantly. So it can be, as many people mentioned, can be due to the very aggressive fiscal stimulus and the stimulus packages. But at the same time, maybe financial market, rightly or wrongly, have a more positive expectation that sometime soon medical advance will be made. But I think the risk is there. And then on top of that, if there is a correction of this, you know, the perception, the sharp adjustment can actually have a negative impact on real economy, like in other regions. But in case of Asia, what we are worrying about is if that happens, capital outflow pressure can resume. That will make our, you know, our economies much more vulnerable. So I think that is heavily, that is why I say that it can happen because of the risk sentiment suddenly changes. For example, if everyone knows that, oh, vaccine won't come in very soon, then how the financial sector reacts? So either risk attitude can change suddenly, that's one risk. The other risk is that even if the you know, there's a vaccine is developed, but there is a rewinding of the advanced economies, you know, stimulus packages, which is good for the advanced economies. But even the rewinding happens, when the global interest rate come up and the capital outflow happens, then Asia can be vulnerable too at the time. So in either way, if the you know, there is abrupt adjustment or if there is a rewinding at the time, then there is a good reason why Asia policymaker has to be very cautious on this possibility.
All right, thank you very much. I actually have one final question now. I know we are now getting we're already at 4 o'clock and 10 o'clock your time, but I thought this was a very, very good question, which I got from one of the people in the audience, who was asking if we could end on an optimistic note. He was saying there are a couple of factors which leads us to some more optimism when it comes to the Asia-Pacific region and its ability to recover. He says, firstly, there were a couple of dogs that didn't bark, and one of them would be the fact that we haven't had, at least we haven't seen materialized, big fears we have about sort of a strong emerging market outflow type of crises that we talked about in the beginning of the year and moving into the height of the crises. Then he points to the oil price, that the oil price is relatively low. And then he's asking, are there other factors you can think about which gives sort of some more optimism than we usually have when we're talking about the economics these days?
I think he or she mentioned two positive things I would easily mention. One is this, I really think that this time, advanced economy stimulus packages helped many Asian countries because it stabilized the capital outflow. Unlike 2009, when they actually use a stimulus, there is a lot of appreciation pressure in Asia economy. But this time, I think since Asia is also suffering from the COVID, the expansionary, you know, unconventional monetary policy in advanced economies definitely helped Asia. So that's good news. And the oil price, very sorry about the oil exporting countries, but many oil import Asian countries, this is a positive factor. I don't know how long it will last, but I think these are two positive factors. And the third thing, if I have to mention, is that depending on the countries, depending on the export product, there's a more online-based, more digital economy-based economy, sees that they can perform better than the others. So, you know, in Asia, depending on which country, I can see there's some good signs. But overall, I think there are many others who will suffer more. So at this moment, to speak frankly, I want to be optimistic, but what I'm looking at it is that the damage has been done already. So maybe this will give a good lessons. In my opinion, if there is any benefit of this, this crisis, it really reminds Asia this is time not to waste a crisis, and we do the more structural decision to make our economy more infrastructure oriented and digital infrastructure oriented. We have to build a social safety net, especially on unemployment insurance. We have to really build up our automatic stabilizer, and then also we have to protect our people's livelihood at the same time. And so in some sense, it gives us a direction where we have to go. And, you know, the shock happens. And so in that sense, it gives a wake-up call. We cannot rely on the low product, cheap product export alone. So that is, I think, also, even for country which rely on tourism, we cannot rely on the very low-cost mass travelism. We have to really increase our value up for new environment. So I think this may be the one good lesson that we can learn from this crisis.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Ray. This has been a very educating hour that we've spent with you. Thank you for carving out time in your morning in America. It's been a great pleasure having you speaking at our event.
Thank you very much for this opportunity.
And also thank you to all the attendees here. Thank you for joining us, and see you soon.